attendance are Representatives Foxen, Phillips, Fritz, and Locker. We have today two bills, and I'd like to work on House Bill 396. If we can, I'd like to be able to move it out. It's an important bill, one that Community and Regional Affairs says that they need. We have someone with us today that's going to testify on the bill, someone that is representing the administration. Do I have a sign-in sheet, though?
Yeah.
Doug, did you sign in?
Yeah.
Thank you. We have Doug Griffin, who is with Community and Regional Affairs, and your title, Doug?
Madam Chairman, I'm a local government specialist for the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and I'm here to talk on House Bill 396. I'm going to keep my comments real brief. Your office asked for some numbers, and I will be happy to talk to them as well to give you some perspective of the amount of money that's going to communities that are not now required to do any type of independent audit. And I apologize for not having them in final form and all written, but I think you'll basically get an idea of the dollars that are going out to second-class cities and unincorporated communities, and I will be getting a written copy summarizing all of this over to your office sometime tomorrow.
Okay.
Basically, the one thing that our department certainly does not want this legislation to be viewed as is any type of punitive legislation that's requiring second-class cities to have to do audits. There's no feeling in our department certainly that there's a problem, that there's, you know, a massive problem out there with funds being misused. It's just a feeling that we feel that communities are becoming more sophisticated. Audits are an excellent management tool for them to have available to them, and we would think that perhaps the legislation that allowed second-class cities to do certified financial statements instead of audits was written in an era when there was not the large amount of money going out to those communities, and now, even with reduced revenues, it's still the volume of funds going out is substantially greater than what had gone out just a few short years ago. For an example, there would be about 30 second-class cities who would fall under this legislation, that being that they received in FY82 more than $100,000 when you combine the state revenue sharing, municipal assistance, and the raw fish tax funding. These 30 communities received slightly over $5 million. In funds under these programs, and
not subject to audit under the law.
And they were not subject to any type of audit, just a certified financial statement. This financial statement is prepared in-house by the local city staff and certified as to be, you know, to the best of their knowledge, to be true and correct and accurate, signed by the city council or the governing body. In this case, the city council. So. The largest area has been in the area of legislative grants. These are individual projects, and they're covered under a different section of the law. I think section 3, which deals with AS 3705-318. Now, this is the section that would allow us to have some discretion. I should point out that it talks about the state agency may require an independent audit if the project is over $100,000. This permissive language just gives us the ability to say if it's just a large equipment purchase or a fairly straightforward transaction that we would have the discretion not to require an audit, but if it's going to be a construction project or a more involved type of project, that it would be, we would have that discretion to say, okay, well, you need to plan on setting aside some money to do an audit of the final project. In this case, just our department alone, and this is, we do not primarily deal with cities. That's usually handled by the Department of Administration. But our department has either just closed out or has still open on the books some 61 grants, which total over $14 million. So there's an example of a lot of funds going out for various types of either capital improvements or equipment purchases that, again, by law under AS 37 is not subject to audit.
How much money?
Slightly over $14 million. And that has gone out over more than one fiscal year, over the last couple of fiscal years.
Representative Fritz has a question. So we're talking about, before he does, $19 million or not?
So far, yes.
$19 million so far, not subject to audit. Thank you. Representative Fritz?
What are they subject to in the way of accountability?
Well,
Chairman,
the legislative grants are under a contract, and there is financial reporting required. Usually the way the mechanism is set up is a portion of the money will go out, and then they will have to meet financial reporting requirements to get further installments of their payments. So it's basically, before you get your next, say 20% is paid up front, before you can get your next 20%, you have to account for the first amount of money and give us an idea how the second installment would be used.
Is there a form for reporting that's uniform throughout the state?
We're pretty, not throughout the state. Within our department, we have forms that are available that they can use. If they prefer to use something else, we're pretty flexible on our end. We just like to get the information. And if they've got a bookkeeping system that's not exactly meshes with our forms, and they can use that, but we will provide them forms that they desire.
All right. In this piece of proposed legislation, are you suggesting that they all have a uniform method of reporting? Because I know there's such a thing known as innovative accounting, which certain companies use to make their stock look a lot better than it really is. So I'm wondering if you have some standard form that these financial statements will be submitted on.
Well, he's suggesting an audit.
An audit is a standard thing?
Subject to audit. Yes, it is. It is in organized rules.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to know. I guess I should have asked that.
But I guess it was because at one time there was such little money going to these people that no one considered it necessary.
That was the intent originally, just to give a little historical perspective. Is that in not that many years ago, many cities were getting, say, $3,000 under state revenue sharing, and maybe another couple thousand under municipal assistance, and maybe all of the money they got would amount to $10,000, and they would have to use maybe half of that to pay for an audit. And so that's where this idea of a certified financial statement came about. But then the municipal the state revenue sharing program was changed in 1980, providing a minimum entitlement of $25,000 plus a cost of living adjustment. Municipal assistance went through a great increase there a couple of years ago with the large supplemental that was passed, and it's basically a different ball game. So the final thing I was going to point out is just, we do have a few second-class cities that we do have legislative grants or Senate Bill 168 grants with. Mainly these are cities that have incorporated since we gave them the grant, and so there's another $3 million roughly right there. So, and I have not, the one thing that I've not computed yet is the Senate Bill 168 or this 8 unincorporated communities. And there, again, there's a substantial amount of funding. I would probably several $1 million there. So probably talking about in our agency alone, well, not some of this involves municipal assistance and raw fish tax, which are handled by the Department of Revenue. But just in these numbers I've given you, you're getting close, probably up to near $25 million in funds that are where there is, I'm not going to say there's not accounting. There is accounting for the funds, but they're not in the form of an audit.
Yes, Representative Clarkson.
I have three questions. First of all, what is the cost of an audit to one of these communities? I assume they would have to pay the cost out of whatever they receive. Second question is, if you've got a list, would you read some of the examples of the second-class cities that receive over $100,000 so I can get a feel for what kind of communities? Mm-hmm. And thirdly, I'm still not clear what occurs in an audit that makes it better accountability than what you've described that you have now in your contracts.
Okay. The first question was the cost. Now, probably the best thing that we can look at is there are, right now, first-class cities have to do an audit, and there are a few first-class cities that are pretty small. In fact, their populations are basically in the range of second-class cities. And a lot depends on how good their bookkeeping is. Sometimes the auditor has to go in there and really recreate the books, dig through files. And so a lot depends if they have a pretty good office staff and a good bookkeeper, then the cost will be kept down. These costs usually run anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000, I would say, generally for an audit.
And the audit, if I just on that, the audit would be for all of their receipts, or for example, would you have to have a separate audit for the fish tax receipts and a separate one for?
No, this audit would cover everything. Basically, it would be for their general operating budget. And then if they have a capital budget where they're getting some grants for capital funds, then that might cost an additional amount, maybe another $1,000 or so. But that's partly why this legislation sort of makes that distinction between operating and capital funds. Your second question, a list of the communities. Let me pick up about the largest. Well, there's several. Delta Junction received under these three programs, state revenue sharing, municipal assistance, and raw fish tax. I assume raw fish tax was probably pretty limited at Delta Junction, but $258,615.
How many people at Delta Junction?
About there, they have almost 1,000 people, so that's one of the larger second-class cities.
I don't need to know the dollar amounts, but if you could just give me a rough idea of the various sizes of the communities.
Okay, Unalakleet Clete about 600 to 700 people, 204,000. Angoon here in southeast with probably about 500 to 600 people, about $129,000.
Fair-sized communities, huh?
They generally are the larger second-class cities, that's correct. And I can't point to the magic of $100,000, but there's a point where you've got to decide where we're giving them X amount of dollars, and maybe there needs to be some accountability. But they do tend to be the larger communities. There are some exceptions. Clark's Point here is one of the smaller communities, around 100 people, probably because of their raw fish tax. They are near Bristol Bay. They receive $164,000. So there are exceptions there. Probably the main factor here that's a variable is the raw fish tax, which if it's a fishing community.
Can I continue? I know almost nothing about the raw fish tax. Is it for a designated type of expenditure, or can they, for example, can they take $5,000 from the raw fish tax to do an audit?
They could do that, yes. It's basically a block grant type of money.
I'd like to say something right in here. The law as it is now, at least how it relates to the municipality that I come from, you may require an audit. The money is set aside, and many times the state does not require one because they are comfortable with our bookkeeping practices. And I don't believe this legislation insists that each and every time there will be one. It sets it up so that it may be asked for. That's what
you keep in mind. Another question. Mm-hmm. You're listed 30, about 30 communities, the second-class communities that exceed the revenues of 100,000. How many second-class communities are there that have revenues of less than 100,000? Rough estimate.
Yeah, it would be about 75.
So we're picking up.
You're picking about 31 out of 106. There are 106 second class cities right now.
And typically they're the larger ones.
Typically, yes, sir.
Okay, and then the third question is, what is it about an audit that makes it so special?
Probably just the independent nature of the thing, that you're having someone coming in from the outside, has no ties with the community, per se, other than he's under a contract to do a job for X amount of dollars. Typically, he has to sign off that it meets general accounting principles. And if it does not, he has to list basically some type of disclaimer in the front and reasons for that. And I guess audits get this idea of being a negative tool. And again, I'd like to bring up the point that we feel that communities are receiving more dollars, they've got more irons in the fire, mm-hmm. they've got, and a lot of it is that an audit can be a very positive thing. And just things are, whether they like it or not, things are getting more sophisticated, even in rural Alaska. And that audits can provide a tool for trying to get a better handle on the finances that are going through some of these very small communities that just a few years ago were literally operating out of a cigar box, and now they're getting maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we're trying to do the best we can as working with them. But again, this is viewed by us as a tool to assist them in their financial. Record keeping and accountability, and we've identified financial control as probably the biggest single thing that needs to be addressed in rural communities as far as improving their skills out there in that area.
I guess you're assuming that these are going to be financial audits as opposed to, or I heard the term performance audits.
Right. Yes, we're assuming they're financial audits. audits.
Representative Phillips and then Fritz.
Most of the audits, you know, when I was on legislative council, they had audited us once a year, and it usually ran about $10,000 or under. What's the average cost of an audit, or, you know, you have a feel for that?
Well, a lot depends, again, on the how well the books are. But I, again, the ones that we've had to deal with where the books were in a really a bad shape, say, or the accountant had to, or the auditor had to come in and do a lot of reconstruction of the files and records, it got up to maybe $10,000. You're paying a lot of for, you're paying him whatever, $80 an hour or something to do a lot of clerical work, perhaps.
But that'll change once they know they're subject to audit.
But so those places that basically have their records in order, they come in and they just,
so
there's an audit trail and there's something there and they can pick it up, then you're probably talking about something of half that, maybe 5,000.
Okay, the worst possible scenario is 5,000.
I'd say the worst possible could be up around 10.
10,000. Okay, so the average would be, what, 2,500, 5,000?
I'd say somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000.
Okay.
Fritz,
what's your Fritz? Says audit and financial statement. Are they two separate things?
Well,
the title of the bill.
Well, yeah, financial statement. An audit is what we refer to as being an independent audit. I guess I need to flesh out these terms a little bit more. Whereas a financial statement is, again, it's referred to, I think, in the statute as a certified financial statement. That is where basically an in-house audit, if you want to call it that, an in-house reporting of how the money was spent, and then it's certified as being true and correct by the governing body of the city.
That's what Chrysler and other corporations put out. They put out a financial statement, and all the stockholders get a copy of it, and it's
yeah.
put out by the company itself. Whereas an audit would be something performed by an outside agency?
I think in some cases those terms are used interchangeably, and
that's
what leads to the confusion. In this context, there is a difference. I think in Chrysler's case, they probably have, maybe it's in-house, but I think it is more of an audit type.
Perhaps should have made a happier choice.
Representative McBride and then Phillips.
Well, I'd like to say, even in more sophisticated communities, an audit really helps you. And I recall one time when I was on the borough assembly that over the school administration when it comes to funding, that the auditor suggested that we do a better job in tracing purchase orders. Usually audits give you that kind of information. We adopted that. Now, an audit doesn't say you have to do that, but it shows you where your weaknesses are. And we adopted that, and we're much happier with what was going on the next year when the audit came around again and we talked about how things had improved. So I think an audit does two things. One of them, I think everybody should understand that an audit doesn't necessarily tell you that somebody is embezzling money. I think a lot of people have the idea that that's what an audit is for.
The purpose of it.
Yeah, the purpose. And that isn't the purpose of it in this kind of a case. The purpose of it is to let you know where you could, you're exercising good bookkeeping and business practices. And I think it's real important for communities that don't have this sophistication and as an example, even when you have years of experience and things, you do make mistakes, and that's the auditor's job to tell you about where you can do a better job. Therefore, you're not going to get in trouble with your own constituency and your own community because you are doing a good job.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
That's all I have, Jenny.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny, are you going to testify on this one?
I don't have anything to
add. Okay. Thank you, Dan. Are there any questions from the committee at this time? I'd like to move the bill out.
I move that we move the bill out with individual recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Fitz has moved House Bill 396 with individual recommendations. Is there objection? Hearing none, so moved.
You never did express your own opinion about the bill.
Well, I'm in favor. I guess you know that I kind of took a giant leap when it has your name on it. Do you notice that?
Community
and Regional Affairs, I didn't even ask. But
I
was in a hurry to get
from.
It introduced so we could move it. We have just a little bit of wrap-up work on 172, I believe we have two amendments proposed. And we can move it out. When we were discussing this bill before, we had some people here from the Cape Fox that had an amendment that they wished to propose to the committee. And I believe it's in the file now. So, it seemed to me that there was some discussion the day that you were here, both pro and con, and maybe if you'll come up and talk to us now, or at least, I don't know if there's anyone else to speak to us. And it would be amendment number 8, I guess. No?
Yes.
How come it's on a journal last draft? I guess I have to ask why is it on Senate Bill 260? So you want this from line 5 through page 2, line 20, you would like inserted into House Bill 172. Is that your proposed amendment?
Madam Chairman, where do you see line 5 at?
I'm assuming a lot of that's the same language we already have.
That's what we need to have. I'm afraid I didn't do my homework on this.
Well, the proposed substitute specifically shows where the changes in House Bill 172 occur. It's an amended version of House Bill 172, even though it says Senate Bill 260. It's House Bill 172.
Okay, I guess I have a little problem. It says Senate Bill 260 proposed substitute. But, of course, I can easily see that it's only 2 pages, so it couldn't...
That's right.
It's a proposed substitute for something else. So where would you propose to insert it into 172? That's what I'd like to know.
Okay.
Well, the citation reference is wrong.
This proposal was drafted by Lee Sharp, the city attorney. That's why it says Senate Bill 260. We can send it over to the House Bill 172.
Okay. But would it...
Yeah, just a second.
And excuse me, Don, I didn't pick up on
that. Well, the citation's wrong.
Yes.
This bill proposes to amend 2953.
Yes.
And in fact, that part of House Bill 172, starting on page 101, is 2945.
Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do then. We're going to...
But that's a technical. I
know it. We'll go ahead and let you speak to the amendment. And then we'll, if it's approved, we'll see to it that it's technically
correct. Please make every effort to make it simple.
Yes, very simple.
We also made every effort to make it simple. So what this results from?
Excuse me, could you state your name for the record? We're not going to
do it. Hey, you see something? Mm-hmm. Careful over here.
Yes.
Guessing from you.
Yes. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Kellis Sewell with Cape Fox Corporation. What this results in, the amendment that you're looking at, is a rather lengthy discussion that I myself had and a member of Sea Alaska Corporation, Tony Strong, had with Lee Sharp, the city attorney of Juneau. We both gave, and what this is, and is compromised language that we consider Cape Fox Corporation, obviously better than not having any language at all. We still favor the language in Senate Bill 260 as it passed out of Rules Committee last week. But as far as we're concerned, working with a city representative, this is the best language you can come up with, and we support this and strongly encourage that you pass this language out of the committee of regional affairs.
And insert it into 172, even
right.
Though you have a Senate bill coming over.
Right.
Representative Clausen.
A couple of questions. First is, Jenny, you going to testify?
I haven't seen this.
Okay, well, Mr. Sharp is not here, and obviously there were two conflicting points of view on this that appear to be together, but I'm anxious to see if that's agreement is an agreement with other municipalities? I guess that's just a question for the future. And then, as I understand what's happening, if we look at 105 of our bill, you're basically amending the language that's in 172. So let me ask this just for my own purpose. There's no other wording changes from our bill except the language on land lines 17, 18, 19.
Correct.
In that section. In that case, let me go to this page 2 of the proposed Senate committee substitute. That apparently is new language.
Right.
Right. That would, that says that if the property loses the exempt status because it is developed or leased, then the assessment should be based on full and true value of the improvements to the property, shall be based on the full and true value of the leased parcel and the improvements thereto. I'm not a taxing expert, but I thought you taxed on the potential that the property has. What's that phrase in taxing law?
Highest
and best use. So are you setting up a different standard for taxation of this once it drops out of exempt?
Okay, let me first clarify that this amended portion was not our language. It was suggested by the city attorney, and we agreed to its insertion. We agreed to it in concept, and we'll support it. But I can't really answer any questions really.
What was that phrase you used, Don?
Highest and best use. Seems to me normally you tax property at its highest and best use. Here, they're going to only tax it on the value of the improvements, the improvements that are already imposed on it. It appears to be a different tax.
The assessor sitting right next to us, Representative McBride.
Well, I'm not the assessor, but you don't tax on the best use. It's on fair market value, which is words for saying full and true value.
And full and true value is based on?
Market value. Seller and buyer who have no pressures, seller that has no pressures to sell, and a buyer.
And highest and best use is not taken into account?
No.
What did when they zone something commercial, even though it's...
Then that increases
its market value, probably, or in some cases it could decrease it, too.
Too bad we don't have the assessor here from CNRA.
I could, and basically, I think what Representative McBride is saying, that the state law talks about full and true value, and in most cases, I think that's probably the highest and best use as well.
Okay, that's
the zoning.
Okay.
Main thing is I didn't want to give special tax status to this once it's kicked out of its exempt status.
No.
And
okay. It's the city attorney's language. So.
Thank you. Do you know of any other municipalities or areas other than Southeast where this may have a substantial impact?
Possibly Coquimbo Association would have a concern, municipality of Anchorage, maybe. That's just my conjecture.
I'd sure like to know what they had to say about this.
We're not going to move on this amendment, and we're going to hear from Jenny. If we don't feel comfortable with these two amendments that have been presented to us so late, the thing to do is for us to go ahead and move it out of committee and send the amendments along. Jenny, are there any more questions for this one? Thank you. Jenny, would you like to talk to us now? You have a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Jenny Chitwood, Alaska Municipal League. The representative of the assessors met with the Cook Inlet Region Native Corporation last week to try and develop compromise language. And then the Assessors Association is meeting today and tomorrow to go over proposed language. So they're hoping to have something for you very shortly. The reason the citations in this proposal that Lee drafted refer to current Title 29. That's why the numbers are different from the proposed revision. I'm sure the reason the assessor's not here is because he's the state assessor, is because he's at the assessor's meeting. I would say that all of the municipalities that have native land within it would be affected by this bill, so it's quite a bit more widespread than just Southeast Alaska. And then there was one question that I had that I don't know if it's been asked or answered is, this applies to the native land under the Native Land Claims Settlement Act. Does this definition, if a definition is put in law, of developed, does it automatically expire in 1994 or whenever all of the native lands goes on the tax rolls? I mean, 1994, I believe, is the date when their special status expires.
Of course, that's what Representative Clarkson wants to be sure we're not doing. We're not getting involved in that afterwards. This is only something between now and then. And of course, we've had the previous witness tell us that that's what we were doing. We'll check this out before the assessors get back to us. We'll also put it in proper language. I think it's important that we address the issue. Mm-hmm. Either that or just leave it out. But I think that probably we're better capable of addressing the issue than any other committee doesn't go to. So,
one thing I was thinking is that it might have a special expiration date, if there's some question. The other question that's been raised is, does the state have the ability to define a term in federal law? And there's probably not an answer to that question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to raise that. I did notice, by the way, a difference in this wording than in our existing law that's not underlined, and it's the language on, and I'm speaking to the proposed Senate substitute, the language on lines 13 through 15 is different than the language in our bill on page 105 of 10 through 12. One of the significant differences I might point out is the addition of the phrase unless superseded by applicable federal law. So I was going to ask that same question. I just want to flag that for you. It is different. It seems to be improved because it at least covers the possibility that we can't do this.
Any other questions for Jenny? Representative McBride?
Well, I guess as a comment, I think we would be wrong to leave it out.
Oh, yeah.
Because the question does have to be answered.
I think so, too. But what we don't want to do is jeopardize the bill by putting something in there that's too controversial. We have another bill coming over with it. And, you know, we've all kind of stayed away from putting anything in here that would hurt this bill. And so it's definitely a problem that needs to be addressed. And if we can address it in this bill, then we've done a better job with it. Looks like if we can accept this language, the people involved will accept it, and then we can go forward.
And if I might, there's one more comment I made, that to cut the language off, so to speak, on a certain date, as that date approaches, it very well could change for various reasons.
The date Jenny was thinking of is the date when it would be cut off anyway, unless we changed it.
Well, but the federal government could change that date too, so.
Still, we're basing this on that, Jack. We could always come back and change this, too, if there was good reason for that.
I assume we could. I just wanted the committee to be aware of that.
Representative Clark.
Well, I think Representative Bryant has a good point. You ought to tie it to whenever the exemption is repealed, if that's 1991 or if it's in the year 2000. And you can certainly draft that. I think I heard you say you wanted to try to move on this today. I would. Because of the sensitive nature of this issue in the last couple of years, I'd be inclined not to support adding this amendment until I have time to talk to my municipality.
Yeah, I agree. And I had never planned on moving the amendment. I planned on just sending it on with these two amendments. But I think that this is important enough that these people have done this work and we should try to get it inserted. We will do a full analysis. We will draft it in its proper form, tell you exactly where it's going to fit into this bill before we have our meeting on Wednesday. That will give people a chance to touch bases. And then we'll also have the assessors back, right, Jenny?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then we'll know where we're going with it.
Nobody will be back on Wednesday.
We'll certainly know how they feel about this piece of legislation.
Okay. Who are the assessors you made reference to?
The state assessor is meeting at some sort of state convention, Jenny?
A meeting of the Municipal Assessors Association.
And they know that this is an issue. And hopefully they'll be able to support some language like this.
And then that means this whole thing has to be done all over?
Oh, no. This is all going to be retyped anyway. We've already made lots of amendments. This just be one more amendment, amendment number 8. And we'd tell you exactly where it's going to be inserted.
Okay.
Which I'm a little uneasy of. I
guess I don't understand quite what your wishes are.
Okay. I had first hoped that we could move it out.
Uh-huh.
Okay. First of all, I didn't realize that it was drafted in this form, and I really didn't do my homework on it. So what I'm going to say, rather than move it out and send these two amendments, one was just brought to us about an hour ago, and then this one, along to judiciary, I would prefer to go ahead and do the homework on these two amendments. minutes between now and our next meeting, giving everyone an opportunity to touch bases with their municipalities, also giving the state assessor an opportunity to get back to us, tell us whether this is the best language or whether there's something better that the assessors will support. We're looking to solve this problem with something that has the support of the people in the state so that it doesn't jeopardize the stock.
I like that idea.
Okay. So then we'll also do the same thing on the REA request that came in just before we came down here. However, we have someone here that would like to talk to us about it. We'll go ahead. I think you already did that one, though. Okay. Okay? Okay, if there's nothing further on this amendment for this time, we'll go ahead and ask the gentleman that represents the REAs, I believe, in the state to come forward and talk to us about what we now call amendment number 9.
Okay, thank you. Dave Hutchins, representing the Electric Co-op Association. And I noted that the chair's comment that she was reluctant to add anything to the bill that would make it controversial, but I assume that you'd be equally concerned about making it controversial by leaving things out. And I would remind the committee that this recodification repeals everything that's an existing law in this code. And if you don't include it in this bill, you've repealed it, you've changed the law. All I'm after is to keep the law as it is in relation to the utilities. Now, the cable TV people have some of this language in here that is slightly different from the existing law. But what I presented is the language from the Senate bill relating to utilities, all of the entire section. And I explained this to the committee 2 or 3 weeks ago, in concept at least. There's one change that I've made in this from what I described to the committee, and that's down here at the bottom of the last page, where it says K, a public utility that is exempt or partially exempt under D through J of this section from the provisions of 4205.010 to 7.21 may not be regulated by a municipality. That had been through from, I think it was C through J. The one eliminated from that, or perhaps it's B, the one eliminated from that was the miscellaneous section. A group of miscellaneous services have been defined as utility services, and this would, by including them in this provision here, it would have kept the municipalities from regulating them, and Mr. Sharp made quite a point in his testimony that there'd be no good reason why the municipality should not regulate them. I speak neither for nor against those people, but I wanted to, in the spirit of trying to work out something with Mr. Sharp, propose that be deleted from the exemption. I'm sorry you feel that this came in rather late. It did come down telecopied 10 days ago. It wasn't as clear a copy as I understood. It's already been in your file for a week or so. And I'd given it to the staff the day that this language was adopted by the Senate committee several months ago. Apparently got misplaced somewhere along the way.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought I saw you bring it in about 5 minutes.
Well, I did. This is a clean copy.
Oh, a clean copy. All right.
Easier to read, that's all.
So then I'll have to say that it was not brought to my attention. It means I haven't perused it. Will not.
I did want to stress to the committee that all I'm after is to keep the present law as it is.
Any questions for the gentleman?
Just a second.
Tamara, could you come to the table and give us a little background? I've already forgotten it. It's been so long. Why the committees, while working, wish to delete the material that would keep the regulations of utilities the way it is? I know you sat in on most of their meetings and
yes.
Drafting, so maybe you give us a little background on why we're presented with this problem. In your packets, I think I supplied you with a copy of the existing statute as it relates to utilities. Right now, a municipality is able to regulate essentially only municipally owned utilities. The original approach adopted by this bill was to allow municipalities to regulate both municipally owned utilities and utilities that are regulated by APUC to the extent that they are not, you know, to the extent that they are not being regulated by APUC. So theoretically, a utility which was under some sort of a form of even partial regulation by APUC, but some regulatory gaps were left, might possibly be subject to a certain amount of municipal regulation. In any case, a utility that was not being regulated by APUC, whether or not it was municipally owned under the original version, would fall under municipal regulation. Now, that has been changed in subsequent versions. There have been quite a few changes in the area. Philosophically, I believe, I know I'm being a little bit simplistic on this, but philosophically, I believe the utilities have, to a certain extent, taken the position, and APUC, as I understand it, agrees with them, that when the state made the determination that certain types of utilities ought to be deregulated, that having made that philosophical determination, it ought to apply with respect to local regulation as well as to state regulation. And so some versions of the bill have taken that approach. They've adopted proposed language that would essentially allow a municipality to regulate utilities only if they are not exempt from state regulation by APUC as well, so that this once again narrows municipal authority in this field, so that if the legislature makes a determination that a utility ought not to be regulated by APUC, then it also will not be regulated by a municipality without the legislature necessarily having to address that particular issue in the legislation. Of course, the legislature could, in considering a particular utility such as cable television, specifically provide that APUC may not regulate this and municipalities may not regulate this. But what they're attempting to do, as I understand it, is to tie the structure so that that will happen as a matter of course unless the legislature speaks affirmatively and grants a new power to a municipality. I don't know whether your bill also, or whether the latest clean copy, which I'm not sure that I have, addresses the question of municipal ability to regulate adjacent to utilities that are adjacent to its boundaries, but that's an issue that has also come up, and I know it's been addressed in front of this committee before. I'm not sure that it's included here, but there was also a request to go back to existing law as far as extraterritorial provision of a utility service so that a municipality could not provide a service unless it was in an area that was adjacent to its boundaries, which is existing law, and that has been construed by some court opinions. In that area, municipalities feel that most of the testimony that I recollect on that from municipalities is essentially that they felt that they ought not to be limited to servicing a particular area adjacent to their boundaries since they are now subject to certification of need by APUC anyway, and their territory is as rigidly designated as that of a private utility. And so consequently, they felt they ought to be able to get a certificate of need to service an area that might not necessarily be adjacent to their boundaries if APUC. Representative Cox.
This is very complicated, but the memo from staff is very helpful. But as I understand, types of utilities we're talking about, they're almost all small utilities that are measured by gross income, because those are the exceptions from APUC regulation, isn't that right?
One difference, the subsection H that's referred to there is the electric co-op, electric telephone co-ops.
And there's your interest.
That's right.
So there are in this state electrical co-ops who are not regulated by a municipality and have elected not to be regulated by the APUC.
That's correct, by a vote of their members.
And they cover the area just of their membership. The service population is the same as their membership.
That's correct. Each one receiving service is a member and votes in the annual meeting, elects the board of directors who then...
How many of those are there? Where are they?
There are only three, I think. Glacier Highway Electric at Off Bay, Naknek Electric, and Cordova Electric.
Are they now being regulated by their municipalities?
No.
Are their municipalities trying to regulate them? No, because the present law...
I,
we have suspected that that was the reason that this was proposed last year, that got put into it last year.
What's the third one? Glacier, Naknek, and
Cordova.
And Cordova. And we also have Cordova Telephone that is exempted. As far as I know, those are the only ones that that have successfully been deregulated by the election process.
Representative McBride?
I'm like Representative Clausen. It's a little bit hard for me to understand. It seems like I might have even asked you this question once before, but the Ketchikan Public Utilities is owned in effect by the city of Ketchikan and its residents. However, it extends its services out into the borough. And as I understand it, they're not regulated by APUC, is that?
That is correct. The only municipality in the state that is regulated by the APUC is Anchorage.
Okay. Now, and this says that a municipality may only extend utility services to an area adjacent to the municipal boundaries. How does that come about that we go beyond that?
That's the existing law today, and to the best of my knowledge, there has never been a case where there is an area seeking service that could not get it. Where you get into a problem is if a municipality tries to go leapfrogging across service areas from some other utility and get the developing area on the other side of the neighboring utility, that's the problem that we're trying to deal with. And that's the reason the law is as it is today, and it's been interpreted by the courts and been all the way through the Supreme Court, and we sure don't want to open that can of worms again.
One more question. There's talk, and it could have happened a number of different ways. For an example, of the Tai project, Intertie with Ketchikan, which would then extend possibly to Borax, which would not only be out of the boundaries of the city, but also the borough would jump a Portland Canal and over into the village that Borax sets up. Does this create any kind of a problem with this kind of language that either of you see?
No, it doesn't, in my view, because I think that any kind of utility can obviously interchange power with some other utility. And the power authority at this point, at least, is the one that owns the transmission lines. You'd be exchanging power from one community to another over that. And in terms of providing power to Borax, their plans call for a substantial town at the site, and they will have to have a utility there. It may be an extension of or an operating division of Ketchikan Public Utilities, or it may be a division of Borax that operates and becomes certificated as a public utility, or it may be some other entity. But there'll have to be somebody certificated as a public utility to serve that area, because you're going to have more than 20 consumers there.
So you don't see this as a problem?
No way.
I have a question, Dave. If, in fact, in my community, MEA has our entire borough and part of Eagle River, or all of Eagle River, I guess, which would be part of the Anchorage borough, if, in fact, we voted against deregulation, but if we had voted for deregulation, what you're saying then is the city of Palmer or the Massey borough cannot step in and regulate within their boundaries. That's what this would do.
That's absolutely right. Can you imagine the chaos we had had if Matanuska Electric had been deregulated and the city of Palmer regulated in one direction and the city of Wasilla in another and the city of Eagle River imposed yet another kind of regulation on Matanuska Electric? It'd be an unworkable situation.
I'm not sure of that, but I have to think about it. I'm wondering, had we been deregulated, would we have looked towards any government if we felt abused in any way? I'm wondering who we'd have gone to. Probably they would have gone to the borough.
That you would have done. If you had been deregulated and the consumers felt abused, they had their procedure for redress within the cooperative as owners of the cooperative. And if that failed, they still felt that the situation wasn't to their liking, then the law provides for another election to be held to go back into public utilities.
But it's so slow compared to government. A local government would react much quicker than having to call an annual meeting or a special meeting, getting the petitions, all of that. I mean, local government officials are more receptive and would have looked into it immediately I'm just wondering if maybe that isn't one of the reasons why it was defeated. I know that
it's very likely that the larger utilities will never be deregulated under that current provision. That's fine. If people want to be under APUC regulation, that's their option. But we very strongly feel that it should not then trigger regulation of a chaotic nature by the municipalities where you've got them just picking off on all
the
sides.
The other thing that can happen is somewhat what happened to us in this last election and the election before. You have a heavily populated area get stirred up about an issue, busload people into the annual meeting and take over, if you will, try to take over the board of directors. Meanwhile, the people in the entire borough suffered because someone was elected that caused this confusion for so long, and a lot of money and a lot of time was concentrated on the defeat of that individual and the defeat of a possible takeover of the Eagle River area of our cooperative. So certainly in a case like that, I'd have felt a lot better if there was a municipality who did have control, could have control to regulate anyway, if it was out from under APUC.
Well, I'm very much aware of the problem you're discussing there on the board for the last year. But the procedure that you now have in Matanuska Electric for election by mail ballot, that will provide a broader base of participation in the election process now that you've grown so large.
Now that we've done that.
Right? Anytime that a co-op gets above about 10,000, they need to have the election process by mail at least an option. It may be useful in smaller co-ops too, but that needs to be 10,000 or more.
It's just a difference of philosophy, I guess, if in fact you think monopolies should be regulated or not.
They're regulated by their own people, by their own consumers.
Yeah,
consumers can't control it in their own interest, too, in the world.
If monopolies were expected to be regulated by their own consumers, there wouldn't be federal laws and state laws to regulate monopolies. I think anytime you give someone a monopoly, the consumer doesn't always do the job that's required. Of course, I voted against deregulation. I believe we belong under APUC as a monopoly, but I'm just Representative
Fitz? You spoke about deregulation. Deregulation from what?
From Alaska Public Utilities Commission.
And now they run their own?
Mm-hmm. The thing is, no one else can. They have a monopoly. No one else can come in. Deregulation, they don't want to go that far. They don't want to go so far that there can be competition.
I didn't think there was any choice. I thought APUC regulated all utilities.
Well, there is a mechanism in structure, a mechanism in place whereby a membership can come out from under that regulation. And it is being tried regularly, and I understand successful on three cases.
There have been four elections, three of them at Gary and one at Fayette.
Yes, three times have been successful. Apparently, these people must be doing all right. We're not hearing about it anyway.
Ask another question.
Certainly.
You use the word intertie, and that seems to be getting into the vocabulary more and more, specifically between Anchorage and Fairbanks. Is that some kind of an electrical dingus of transformers? And
it's strictly a transmission line. To refer to it as an intertie rather than a transmission line is just a function of how you utilize it. When you use the term intertie, you normally think in terms of exchanging power back and forth alternately from one end to the other, rather than all of the power continually going from one end to the other direction.
And speaking about Matanuska Valley, and Mapsu rather, so what intertie is that? That's a new one that I never heard of.
What's that again?
You mentioned an intertie in your testimony, and you didn't have reference to Fairbanks and Anchorage. I wondered what
in southeastern, you meant. In southeastern Alaska.
Which one is that?
The Power Authority has built, or is in the process of completion, of the construction of Swan Lake, Ketchikan, and Tai'i project. And there are substantial transmission lines there, and there's a study underway to determine the feasibility of building another transmission line, which would be an intertie between Swan Lake and Tai'i Lake, so that you could move power back and forth between those two regions.
Those two places on Revillagigedo Gato Island?
No, I think that's what you're missing. Tai'i is in Wrangell and Petersburg, and Swan Lake would be a Ketchikan, and Tyee is not Ketchikan Public Utilities Dam. Swan Lake is.
That's all. I don't mean to hold you up.
No, that's fine. We're in no big rush. Any more questions for the witness?
If I might add a couple of other items, there's the discussion is focused on the territorial expansion and whether you're regulated or not. There is more in this amendment than just that. I call your attention over here to the fact that this includes the language for conflicts between 29 and 4205. The 4205 would become valid. In other words, if municipal code and the utility code differ in regard to regulating utilities, the utility code dominates expressness. And this would also provide, as both of these are present law, but they'd be repealed if you don't adopt the amendment, as I understand it. This also provides that you have the disputes to be resolved by the EPUC in case there's a dispute between a municipality and a utility. And I think you've seen ample opportunity for these kinds of disputes to arise. There needs to be an arbiter rather than going to the courts all the time. And present law provides that you go to the EPUC, and we think that needs to be retained.
Now, what is the nature, what's the nature of these disputes?
Well,
it's all elementary to you, but I'm not in the electric.
Okay, you can certainly have a lot of disputes between utilities and municipalities in regard to such things as utility right-of-ways. What kind of fee there's to be, I suppose, this sort of thing. I'm not sure what all individual items would be, but it's not uncommon for there to be differences of opinion between municipalities and utilities.
Dave, who would we go to then if, in fact, right now we keep in place the opportunity to always go to Alaska Public Utilities for the dispute? Then what happens if, in fact, the members themselves deregulate? What happens to municipalities then? Because they're not allowed to regulate, according to this. And then they don't have APUC to go to anymore. And then the code for utilities is the one that is overriding the municipal code. It looks like we're setting the municipalities up for a big fall. Is there a safety net there somewhere? Or, I mean, I know who you represent, but thinking in terms of the long term, is there a safety net so that there is someone for these people to go to if they're deregulated and the municipalities aren't allowed to regulate? And there's a problem. Is there someone for them to go to?
Yes, there's, okay, two methods here. One is in the co-ops. You go through the election process, through the meetings, through the hearings. The board members are elected by the consumers, and they're responsive to the consumers that elected them, just like the city council is elected, is responsive to the people in the city that elected them.
Not really.
Aren't you responsive to the people that elected you? Why do you think
I am? I'm thinking of our board members. Have you ever been to a board meeting as compared to a council meeting or assembly meeting?
Yes, I have.
I've been both.
Is there some kind of an upheaval going on in the electrical transmission and generating business throughout the state or throughout parts of the state?
There's a great deal of development. It used to be that that all of the state was in isolated communities, each with its own separate generation and distribution system. And it's only been in recent years that you've had the trend of the communities being tied together by transmission lines to create a more reliable and more efficient electrical system. And there hasn't been any development of that kind for a period of, say, 10 or 15 years. Until now, and it's suddenly happening again.
You must understand that I'm no expert.
Well, me
stuff.
Too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. I realize that we have a problem here, but it just seems like we're only solving one group's problem instead of everybody's. If we could come together somewhere, it seems to me we're always at opposite poles here when it comes to utilities and municipalities. And
well, it seems to me that in regard to the utility provisions in the municipal code, it's been working very well with no problem on it. And and I want to keep it that way. But when you start repealing a bunch of stuff, as the code does, and don't reenact the existing law, we've got serious problems. And you talk about having some fights between municipalities and utilities, we want to have them if we don't keep the law intact.
Yes. Sure.
You mentioned with respect to the new section 2935075, the disputes and conflicts section, that Title 29 revision bill would repeal something dealing with disputes and conflicts. What section would that be that where disputes and conflicts is now addressed in existing law that would be repealed under this bill?
I'm not sure I could tell you. I'm just telling you what the Public Utilities Commission was upset about last year when they asked for a veto of the municipal code because it wasn't in there.
Well, could you get that for us? Because
sure.
We need to have that.
Sure. I'll find that out for you.
Well, what part of the law is being threatened now that will result in the chaos that you mentioned?
You
said that if a certain law isn't kept or allowed to stay in force, that chaos would result.
Okay, the language that I gave you that you have as a proposed amendment to House Bill 172, and what number did you give this?
Number 9.
Okay, now I'm straight.
That's what I'm suggesting to you is needed to keep the, for the most part, it keeps the present law as it is. The area where it does not is related to cable TV people, I think.
And then also, he has said...
I've got it now.
Okay,
but I understand.
He has said that we are repealing law that has kept this chaos from occurring. He doesn't know that exact law, but he's going to get it back to us. And I am wondering if that is really true, Dave, if there really is a section that, if it isn't more than one, that's kind of kept it the way it is. You might have trouble finding one, you know, or might take a little research.
I'm also concerned about the chaos that would occur, Representative Fitz, perhaps if you, when you have large utility, if it ever occurred, where you had a large one that was deregulated from APUC, and you had each of the different municipalities in it, maybe three or four, regulating in different directions with different rules and everything. It'd make an impossible situation for the utility to function efficiently.
Well,
I
understand, so I'm beginning to catch the cookie here on this business. If municipalities and power projects such as the one that Jack just mentioned continue developing and continue being deregulated, what's APUC going to do to justify its existence?
Well, I don't think there's going to be a great number of new deregulations, at least among co-ops. And what deregulations you have are likely to be among the smaller co-ops. Those are the ones that have approved it. And I think that the Public Utilities Commission is a fine institution. If the people that are served by the utility think that their utility needs to be an institution, if they need to be regulated, that's where it ought to be done. That's where the expertise is.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Okay, well, when we hear this bill, we're going to be prepared to move on 8 and 9, so you'll have to do your homework. And if you'll get back to us, and Tam, maybe you'll research it. I think we already had you research it once.
I've done memos on several aspects, I think, of that.
Of that, and I think maybe you'll kind of gather it together for us.
And then 8 and 9, once we get rid of those, then we'll be ready.
That's
to
it, we're
going to
move this bill out. Yes.
Well, Tam's still here, and I've missed several meetings on this, and maybe we have addressed it, but on page 35 of 172, it's talking about declaring a financial interest in an official action to vote on a municipal body. I have a note here that said, line 4, the presiding officer shall rule on a request to be excused from a vote. And I don't remember who brought it up, we mentioned that request should be from a member of the body.
By a member of the governing body.
Yeah, and not by somebody from the audience. Did we correct that, and should we correct it? We did correct it. Okay, good.
excuse me, I have a note that the committee discussed that and wanted that change made. However, I assume when the committee is ready to direct me to prepare a CS or to attach amendments, I'll get a formal notice to do that. But I have a note to change that page as well.
I'd like to kind of line the committee out a little bit on what our plans are. We don't intend to ease up at all in these last final days. We're going to try and continue to move the important legislation and even the unimportant if we get to that point. I'd like to say that I have tentatively planned for summer's work that we would meet once a month on a weekend for 2 days. And it would not be until September, October, and November. And the scope of work is going to be the Boundary Commission's recommendations to us regarding the possible preparation of legislation that would require areas in the state that are ready for organization to do so, which is a pretty big job. And of course, we will pursue the inequities of organized versus organized federal. I think that I would like to see next year legislation introduced that would be another mandatory federal act, if you will, for the few areas that have been identified by the Boundary Commission. And so I would hope that we could take then that we would be ready for you when we have those meetings, those three meetings, so that we can take those on public hearing to the areas that are going to be affected. In addition to that, of course, we have the governor's bill on the revenue sharing municipal assistance, the joining together of, and we need to work with municipal league. I'd also like our committee, if possible, to attend the municipal league conference. That's all I have planned. I don't know yet. We have that plan for the inner work. So I certainly hope you'll have those 3 weekends open.
Really? You don't know what you're asking, young lady.
I know, but you know what a job that is, and we can certainly never do it during a legislative session. I'll have it all ready for you, or the staff will. I intend to work during that time. I'm not going to be a full-time legislator, so I don't expect you to, but you can give me 3 weekends, can't you?
For you, I do a lot.
Thank you. All right, and then I would also like to say to the committee that we still have Senate Bill 151. And at any time any committee member wishes to bring it up, the votes are on this committee, please let me know in time to give the notice on the floor. And I think I saw a hand up here. Yes, come talk to us.
If I could belabor this horse we're trying to beat to death, I'm Lee Sharp, I'm the attorney for the City of Borough Funeral. I understand Kelly Sewell testified a little earlier on this developed section.
Yes, good. I'm glad you're here.
That is something that Mr. Strong, Mr. Sewell, and I met for about 3 hours to hash this thing around, and this is a compromise. It's not as far as I would like to have gone. It's further than they would like to have gone, but I really think that it's something that needs to be developed jointly, more than just the three of those of us who sat down in that meeting.
Well, you get into zero as in what he's
okay, he's zeroing us in on the Kate Fox proposed substitute to Senate Bill 260.
Okay, that's the definition of developed.
Right. What we decided to do was to put it off, as usual, and wait until the assessors come back to us and see if we don't have something or can't put together something that everyone will agree to that will not endanger our legislation. Otherwise, we're going to have to leave it out.
That, okay? Quite frankly, may be the best solution.
Well, there's some people that sure don't want it left down.
That's a political evaluation of what's going to get through soonest this year. If anything's going to get through this year or not. As I talked to Mr. Strong and Mr. Sewell, it became apparent to me that the native corporations and the assessors and various municipal officials have never all sat down together, as near as I can tell, and talked about our various interpretations and problems. And the problems of Juneau that I would have focused on are quite different than the problems that Anchorage might focus on. They're quite different from what Cape Fox and Ketchikan might be looking at. So while I agree this is a compromise, I really don't want to have my imprimatur on it as the thing we need and must have. I think that it really needs more work, joint work. On the public utility thing.
Yeah, that's a hurting one. I'd like to see that.
What I've suggested in my language, I thought, that most of the problems with utilities have raised.
I don't think so.
There are exemptions from APUC regulation First one in there is things like water wagons and honey bucket wagons and things like that, which the APUC just shouldn't be bothered with, but technically they're utilities. Okay? Seems to me that there's no problem, and nobody's raised a problem with municipalities regulating those. Language I have drafted would permit that regulation if the municipality sees it as necessary. People who sell bottled gas, propane, things like that, could also be regulated, because the APUC doesn't. The next exemption that I recall is for those where the APUC finds that there's no public interest in regulating utility. Again, this would be one that's small, it's technically a utility that needs to be regulated because it's under the statutory definition of a utility, but the APUC sees no need in regulating it. So they make a finding that there's no public necessity in regulating this utility, and they're exempt to the extent the APUC says they're exempt. That's the first exemption I mentioned in here, is that if they also find that they ought not to be regulated by a municipality, then they won't be regulated by a municipality either. I have no problem with that approach, as I suggested it. The reason being, if something goes wrong, the APUC is there to go in and start regulating them again. My concern throughout this has been that there will be utilities out there which should be regulated by somebody, or there should be the ability of somebody to regulate them if something goes wrong. Okay, so for that first one, excuse me, the second one, which I just discussed, the APUC is still there if something goes wrong. They can revoke their exemption. As I recall, the next three have to do with small electric and telephone utilities under a certain gross. If they elect not to be regulated, then they're not regulated. But the fact is, the last section in the APUC statute, which tells you how you can be deregulated, says you may revoke your deregulation by the same process. So, if there's a problem, they can go back in and say there's a problem, come back and regulate us. The same thing applies to co-ops. They can be re-regulated. So I don't think a municipality needs to be there to regulate somebody who has opted out. The APUC is there. Those are the only exceptions that I've set out. Now, as I mentioned in the letter, cable TV becomes deregulated, and the legislature says they ought not to be regulated by anybody. We just add subsection K, or whatever it is that goes into the statute. As to disputes between municipal regulation and use of the streets, and the regulations for use of the streets, and the APUC, those are currently covered under Title 42, very clearly. There's one section which says very clearly that if there's any conflict between an order of the APUC or any other instrument they issue, and any regulation, ordinance, order of a municipality, the one the APUC controls, that takes care of the conflicts, as near as I can tell. If the APUC is active, a municipality may not act to require that they do something contrary to what the APUC says. So the APUC is the ultimate arbiter in those cases. There's another section which deals with the use of streets. And that very clearly says that the APUC is the one which will decide whether any of our rates or regulations or requirements as to the use of our streets are unreasonable. Again, you get into a conflict with the utility wanting them to put their utilities 20 feet underground, they can go off to the APUC. If the APUC says that's unreasonable, whatever the APUC says will control. So those two areas of conflict are already covered in Title 42. The only real difference between what I proposed and what's been proposed by the utilities and was considered on the Senate side is that they make specific reference in Title 29 to those sections in Title 42. All it says is, if you have a dispute on how the streets are to be used, you go to this particular section of Title 42, and that's how it's resolved. Well, Title 42 is all there. So it's merely a drafting problem, as I see it. You want to cross-reference that. And that's about the only difference I see between my proposal and the other's not really a substantive difference, as I can tell. And I'm not aware of any other conflict or areas where there's potential conflict that aren't already resolved as to the resolution method in Title 42. So
I guess I need to say that maybe you and Dave should go have a cup of coffee.
I thought we did that.
Yes, come on up to the table. But we need to, there's some people here that we need to, we might want to both sit down.
For the most part, my problems are with Sharp's language here is not with what he says, but with what he left out.
Okay.
Now, there are a couple of items in here that in the language itself that I do have problems with. You have copies of what he's giving you?
Let's get this and find it. It's here.
I didn't ever see that.
Bob gave me a copy of this other day, and I had a chance to read it over, and the first problem I have with this is down at the bottom of the first page where it starts out one, and then it says two, the extent it is subject to regulation under AS 4205. Mm-hmm. I think that ought to be which is subject to regulation under AS 4205. That's a policy difference, apparently something that we haven't resolved there, because what is the effect of his language would be that if a utility is regulated by APUC, that a municipality can dream up some other kind of regulation that the APUC either isn't doing or hasn't thought about, that the municipality can jump in with that kind of regulation. And the utilities, that's not the present law. And the utilities would oppose that change in the present law. And then on the next page, item two, he's changing it there by saying that that subsection D of 711, he's putting the Public Utilities Commission in the business of deciding whether it would be in the public interest for the municipality to regulate or not. And I'm not sure that they could or would interject themselves into that kind of a decision. That's something that is ordinarily in the province of the legislature to decide. That 711D does not really affect our members very often, but it could at some point. And you get into, I just can't imagine having regulation by both APUC and municipality simultaneously for different things. It looks like it'd be an unworkable system.
You want to respond to that? Maybe it'd be better if we responded to things while they're up.
The first one is in there to cover the situations where utilities are regulated, say, only to the extent of requiring a certificate, a service area certificate. They're not regulated as to rates or practices. That is probably the thing that the consumer is going to be most concerned about, not what the service area is, but what the rates and practices of the utility are. The APUC is not regulating those. All I'm saying is, in this language, then the municipality could come in and regulate, to the extent not regulated by the APUC. It was not meant as a way for the municipalities to weasel in one very narrow area and stir up the pot.
Apparently that's what they think.
If there's a problem there, the APUC could issue an order, certainly saying, this is not where municipalities would go, we're regulating in this area. And then the statute would take care of the rest, because that would be, any attempt by the municipality would be contrary to the APUC order. But just because the APUC has, in the second one then, just because the APUC has decided it does not want to regulate some small utility that's out in the boondocks, it doesn't mean that that community doesn't have an interest in seeing that there's some control on that, that monopoly. And that was the purpose of also having the APUC decide whether or not it was just a decision on their part that they don't want to regulate it, or whether it's a decision that this is a utility that ought to be deregulated and nobody should regulate it. Two different things. One is we don't want to be bothered with it, and we don't want to bother them. And the other is an economic decision that it ought to be deregulated and not regulated by anyone, such as the case that the whole legislation can make that decision. So that was the thrust of this too. That they make a conscious decision, the municipality ought not to regulate it.
Of course, that requirement has never been exercised, up to this point, never been required before. And so, in any case where they may have decided that they would not regulate, they have not also said, but the municipality can't regulate either, because that wasn't an issue. So, that would open the door automatically for each of these utilities then to be regulated by the municipality. And once they stepped in and started doing it, then you're going to be fighting with EBUC as to whether you can continue what you then grabbed on the squatter's rights.
Well, mm-hmm. On to that. there's a utility that sprayed this, but then I don't even know whether any have been exempted under this, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. If there have, then all they need to do is petition for a finding that nobody should regulate them, and then they protect the municipality. As the municipality starts making noise about regulating it, they could always go to the commission and say, we want to do that completely wrong. We ought to be in. If the commission agrees, then that would be the end of the matter. Again, the commission's mm-hmm. going to be the final arbiter of that.
And in this item four in Mr. Sharp's draft, it says that they're exempt. Here, specific exemption by law from municipal regulation, but then he left out the provision that was in the Senate language that exempted some people from regulation. And that's seems to be a circular thing, that you're exempted, if the statute says you're exempted, but then he leaves out the exemption. And this K that's in the Senate.
Well, we're not dealing with the Senate version.
Well, but it's in what I submitted to you, though. I'm trying to compare the two.
But we're not dealing with the Senate version, so maybe go ahead and speak to that.
Madam Chairman, K does not presently exist in law.
That's right.
That was a proposed new section, which merely identified all the preceding sections, which we're talking about. Now, those have been pretty much incorporated in 1, 2, and 3 here. The bulk of them are incorporated in 3, which are the opted-out utilities. So in substance, it's put in there. This was put in really as a catch-all, saying if there's something other than Title 42 that exempts a utility, then the law means what it says. The way the proposed Senate version was referred only back up to those that were exempted from APUC regulations. This number four is actually broader. We're not talking just about Title 42. If there's any place else that they're exempted by, it means what it says.
Then. Some other things that were left out of this draft were the conflict between 4205 and 29. Now, without mentioning it in here as provided in this language that I proposed, do you think that 4205 would be dominant? I can't see here. And if it is, why would you object to putting it in here, too? Maybe it's just paranoia on our part, but by golly, let's tie it down.
Okay, yes, I agree.
Uh-huh. It is fair
enough. Yes. as I mentioned earlier, that to me is a drafting problem. I have a problem cross-referencing statutes and ordinances when I draft them. Mm-hmm. Because lo and behold, somebody will come along and change the cross-reference statute and not pick up the fact that there's some other statute that's relying on that one that you're changing, and you change the, you really foul up the cross-reference section. So as a general rule, I try not to do that. I know a lot of people like to have things cross-referenced so that when you go through it, you've got everything in front of you that flags all the problems throughout the other statutes that you want to look at. So to me, it's just a drafting technique. It doesn't change the substance of the law one bit.
Jim, you want to answer to that?
Yes, if I may. That was a little bit of the thrust that I was trying to get to when I asked my question earlier about this. The witness originally testified that Title 29 repeals certain provisions that now exist, and he implied that the provisions on conflicts and dispute are repealed by the Title 29 bill, and as far as I know, they don't address the issue one way or the other. Those provisions are contained in Title 42 now, and Title 42 is not addressed in this bill. Essentially, the provision on conflicts, as I understand it, does serve as a cross-reference. As a drafter and as a member of the legislature, I'm sure all of you are probably particularly sensitive to how delicate it can be to have a cross-reference, especially where it appears in a title so far away, because that's the kind of trap that that the legislature can fall into often. If they were to move that or change the section dealing on conflict so that it no longer makes sense for it to apply to Title 29, and fail to repeal the cross-reference, you can get into some rather interesting and horrendous tangles. So like Mr. Sharp, my tendency is not to cross-reference things unless it really seems to be absolutely necessary. But in any case, this would be something that the committee could decide. I have no problem with sticking it in Title 29, but I did want the committee to be aware that nothing in the Title 29 revision repeals anything,
that's
to my knowledge, dealing with that subject.
I don't see why there would be any presumption that 4205 would take precedence over Title 29 unless there's something that specifically says so.
It does in 4205.
4205
says
this prevails. I'm sure I have to run.
I think that's good. Thank you so much. If there's nothing more to come before the committee,
And the other thing that he left out was the territorial expansion.
Okay, we are definitely going to have to, Tim, if you'll help us, we'll do our homework on researching this, and we'll see if we can't resolve the problem and have it in proper form for the committee, up or down next time, okay? Thank you. If there's nothing more to come before the committee, it's adjourned.